world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. You've probably never heard of Essilor Luxottica, even though it probably makes most of your sunglasses. Well, now the company is trying something new. Could smart glasses give the iconic multi-billion dollar company a new focus? And the posthumous publication of a Gabriel Garcia Marquez book is causing a bit of a stir. Although he didn't want it published, the English language version comes out today. Should it have been released at all? But first, not long ago in Europe, as soon as winter arrived, skiers would flock to the Alps for guaranteed snow. Nowadays, warmer temperatures mean that they're more likely than ever to be greeted by rain, and not much of the white stuff.
Hardly any snow. And if there is, it's artificial. Winter has been unseasonably warm in Leysin, Switzerland. The skiers here are disappointed.
The impact of climate change isn't just being felt by Europe's skiers. Extreme weather like floods and droughts is increasingly affecting people across the continent. But the political choices in these countries suggest that their citizens don't see fighting climate change as a priority.
Spring in Europe is a few weeks away, but it has been a pretty instructive winter if you're thinking about the effects of climate change. They've become extremely pronounced.
Matt Steinglass is The Economist's Europe correspondent.
This winter, Europe has had floods in the Netherlands. It's had drought in Spain and Portugal. Glaciers are melting. But voters are not voting for parties that want to stop climate change.
So where exactly are we seeing the impact of this extreme weather?
One of the most striking extreme weather events this winter was in the Netherlands in early January. Water levels in the bays in the north of the Netherlands rose to their highest level ever, partly because of prolonged rain in central Europe and prolonged rain in the Netherlands. That also manifested as flooding in river areas in Germany. In southern Spain and Catalonia, there is a water emergency going on. The Swiss Alps have been 3 degrees or more above their historical levels. And I went to Switzerland's Great Aletsch Glacier, which is the biggest in continental Europe, where I spoke to Martin Nellen, who is a guide on that glacier, who's been leading tours there for 45 years.
It's a little bit sad if you, all the scenery, the mountains without glacier for me, it's really sad. I'm talking to the glacier, and the glacier told me we don't need you, but you need us. I was working all my life on the glaciers, and I think it's very sad to see melting down the glaciers.
Martin said he used to step straight from the ice on the glacier into a mountain hut where the group would have lunch. Now it takes a 460-step staircase to get up from the glacier to that hut.
And yet you say that in countries affected by all of this, support for pro-environmental parties is actually falling.
Yeah, you would think that that level of flooding in the Netherlands would shake people up. A quarter of Dutch territory is below sea level. But last November, they had an election, and first place went to a party called the Party for Freedom, run by Geert Wilders, who says he wants to put global climate accords through the shredder. In Germany, the Green Party's popularity has plunged over the past year plus. In Spain, there's a pro-green socialist-led government. They are on the edge of coming apart. And in Switzerland, for a long time, the biggest party has been the hard right Swiss People's Party, which is an anti-immigrant party that also is not terribly eager to spend a lot of money on fighting climate change. They won even more seats in the election last fall, while the Green Party shrank.
Matt, why is it that despite more evidence of climate change, there appears to be more climate skepticism, or at best, apathy?
Political scientists are not terribly surprised that extreme weather events are not tremendously increasing support for policies to fight climate change. One study in Germany around floods in 2013 found that people who were within a kilometer of the flood were a bit more likely to want to spend a lot of money fighting climate change. And another study in Britain found similar results for floods and for heat waves. There were also studies after Hurricane Katrina in the United States in 2005. They find usually that there's a small increase in support for environmental policies and for parties that want to fight climate change, but it goes away. And it doesn't have any effect on convinced skeptics who really don't believe that climate change is happening. In Europe, to some extent, it may be that some governments are actually pretty good at protecting their populations from climate change. So in the Netherlands, for example, there is an independent national water protection authority called the Delta Fund. They get massive amounts of funding. They're planning on spending $17 to $35 billion from now through 2050 to upgrade 2,000 kilometers worth of dikes. People trust them, but it also means that people have a certain possibly false sense of security that climate change isn't going to touch them.
Well, that raises the question about money. Surely cost must also be an issue when it comes to support for green policies.
Yes, the bills for green policies are starting to come due, and voters don't like that. So in Germany, for example, the Green Party shut down some nuclear power plants early at the same time that electricity prices were rising dramatically because of the war in Ukraine. They also proposed a new mandatory policy that new houses had to be built with heat pumps rather than normal gas boilers, which would have cost a fair amount of money for homeowners. And that led their polling numbers to start plunging. Meanwhile, European farmers have been driving their tractors up to Brussels, throwing all kinds of farm-related waste in the roads, blocking highways in protest of policies associated with the EU's Green New Deal, which would stick them with some expensive new anti-pesticide controls and so forth. They have successfully gotten some of those policies rolled back because people are afraid of their political power. Switzerland voted last year in a referendum on a new climate law. They had attempted to get a referendum passed in 2020, but it was voted down. Last year, they did manage to get it passed, but the effort was opposed by the Swiss People's Party, the biggest party, and by the hotelier and restaurant owners group, which seems strange considering that climate change threatens to deprive Switzerland of snow. But ski resort owners, for example, have to use a lot of power for ski lifts and for snow machines. And if green policies mean that electricity is going to get more expensive, that's a big threat for them.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound great for Switzerland.
No. Ski resort owners are trying to adjust. For example, at Aletsch Arena, which is a big resort in Switzerland, they have built their ski lifts on movable pylons so that as the glacier melts and as the mountain shifts, they can actually adjust the position of the station where you land and of the pylons that are carrying the gondolas up. Aletsch Arena has actually been very proactive about climate measures. They ban cars, they ban private snowmobiles, and they get all of their electricity from a hydropower dam in the area. And they're hoping that they will be safe for at least a while from declining snowfall because they're up above 2,000 meters. And apparently until the end of the century, they'll probably keep getting enough natural snow to keep skiing going.
So the ski industry may not be finished just yet, but what about the impacts of extreme weather on the rest of the continent?
It's pretty hard for voters to react coherently to climate change because it's so dispersed across different countries. In one sense, it's connected. If you go to that glacier, to the Great Aletsch Glacier, just on the far side of the glacier, if you go over the next ridge, the snow starts melting and flowing towards the north. It winds up in the Rhine River. It then flows all the way north, 1,230 kilometers, and ends up in the Netherlands, causing the sort of flooding that we saw this winter. But Dutch voters can't control what Swiss voters are going to do about it. Swiss voters can't control how Dutch voters are going to vote. And they both have to deal with the consequences of each other's decisions. Martin Neller, that guide on the alleged glacier who I mentioned earlier, walks on the glacier sometimes with his grandson now. And there's a hut where you can put wishes in a sort of a guidebook up there. Martin said that his grandson had left a wish in that book.
He's 7 years old. Mm-hmm. He's wishing that it gets colder because then the glacier are no more melting.
But of course, it's inevitable that the glacier will continue to melt. Even if further emissions were ended tomorrow, there would be a lot more melting on that glacier. The question is whether the world will act soon enough to prevent the glaciers from disappearing entirely.
Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ori.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
Klein Eyewear by Luxottica. What do you want people to see?
I want you to see fearlessness.
The unexpected.
I want you to see you don't need words to make a statement.
Let them see you in Anne Klein Eyewear by Luxottica.
Over six decades, Italian businessman Leonardo Del Vecchio built the world's largest maker of spectacles and sunglasses, Luxottica. Even our most fashionable listeners can be forgiven for not recognizing that name. But you'll have certainly heard of some of its iconic eyewear brands. And now, it has a new focus.
Luxottica is behind most of the biggest labels for eyewears, from Ray-Ban to Oliver Peoples or Oakley. And it also produces spectacles for European luxury companies such as Armani and Chanel and Prada and Dolce & Gabbana, you name them.
Wendelin von Brido is a senior Germany correspondent for The Economist.
It merged in 2018 with Essilor, a French manufacturer of lenses. It's gone from strength to strength since, and recently reported sales that grew by 7% last year, which is more than many other luxury companies. Because, interestingly enough, Luxottica is considered itself a luxury firm. But now there's actually a strategy shift that's going on. And the world's biggest maker of spectacles wants to become a tech or med tech firm.
How on earth are they going to do that?
They have two big ideas. First, they want to become the leader in smart glasses, which is actually not a new idea. And they themselves have tried smart glasses with Google before.
Now it's time to launch the MyGlass app on your phone. Hit continue to move on with setup. If you ever need more help, check the glass help.
And it was a big flop. There were technical problems. It just sort of didn't fly. But now they are trying again, and Ray-Ban, one of its brands, is partnering with Meta. There's also Apple's Vision Pro, which has reportedly pre-sold 200,000 of its devices at quite a high price tag of $3,499. Ray-Ban is now already on its second iteration. The first iteration in 2021 was a modest success, but now the new one, which was launched last September, has a better camera and a longer battery life. So they hope this will make it more attractive. And it's interesting what these smart glasses can do. They can capture and relay what the wearer sees. There's an inbuilt virtual assistant that can hear and respond to requests. It's a very snazzy gadget.
Wendelin, what is EssilorLuxottica's other big idea?
So its other big idea, and I got the impression that Francesco Milieri, the CEO, was even more excited about that big idea, was to launch glasses with built-in hearing aids. They haven't been launched yet. It'll happen later this year in August. And it's supposed to help those with mild to moderate hearing loss. And that's a group of people as large as 1.25 billion worldwide. And many people shy away from hearing aids, partly because there's a stigma attached to it. You know, you can see this thing in your ear. It's also quite expensive for many. But the good thing about these spectacles, they will look no different to normal glasses. So you don't even notice that somebody's actually using a hearing aid. And possibly even more important, they're cheaper than hearing aids, or at least than the sort of run-of-the-mill hearing aids that are on the market.
Could this idea work?
It could. It has been tried before. There was even in 1956, Beltone tried a hear and see glasses that could hear and see. There was also a German company called Audiophone that tried the same. But the ideas at the time, certainly in the 1950s, sort of didn't really take off. But now the technology has improved a lot. And Luxottica bought Nuance Hearing, an Israeli startup founded in 2015, in order to use its technology for the hearing glasses. And so the Nuance Hearing technology uses an algorithm to detect where sounds are coming from based on when they're picked up by different, I think there's as many as 8 microphones in the spectacles. So the spectacles then isolate and process the voice of the person the wearer is speaking to and then transmit it through tiny built-in speakers. And the good thing about all this is that nothing goes in the wearer's ear. So you really can't see that somebody's using a hearing aid.
So what do you make of the company's pivot to tech?
Well, I think it's a very interesting new direction. I mean, the company's doing well, its sales are growing, and so it's courageous for them to try something possibly a bit risky, right? Because they're investing a lot of their time and their resources into these two big new products. Whether it works and whether they prove to be far-sighted remains to be seen.
Wendelin, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Ori. Thank you.
A seemingly happily married middle-aged woman, Anna Magdalena Bach, makes an annual pilgrimage to an offshore island to lay a bunch of gladioli on her mother's grave.
Michael Reed is a writer at large for The Economist.
She does this every year on August the 16th, staying on the island for just one night and following the same routine. Until one year, when she meets a stranger in the hotel bar and goes to bed with him. And this, in turn, becomes a new routine, each year with a different random man. It's a ritual that begins as controlled, but will come to turn her inner life and her marriage upside down. This is the plot of a slim novella by the Colombian Nobel laureate, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the English language version of which is out today, 10 years after the author's death. The decision to publish it is controversial. It is, in fact, an act of defiance of Mr. Garcia Marquez's wishes. As he declined into dementia, he told his sons, "This book doesn't work. It must be destroyed." Yet his sons decided to publish it anyway. They themselves call the choice an act of betrayal. But, they say, in defending their decision, their father had meticulously destroyed any bit of writing he didn't want published. This manuscript was left intact. One of Mr. Garcia Marquez's sons said when presenting the book in Madrid, if his father had not felt the novella was complete, he would have destroyed it too.
Todo libro que él no terminaba y con el que no estuviera satisfecho era destruido. Entonces, el hecho de que él no destruyó este libro, yo creo que también es un síntoma de que el libro se le volvió una cosa un poquito indescifrable, una cosa que él se olvidó.
The brothers speculated that just as their father's decline prevented him from finishing the book, so it may also have prevented him from realizing how good it was. So, are they right? The master's voice can certainly be heard in Until August. Unusually for Mr. García Márquez's works of fiction, it is mainly set in the present. The unidentified location is unmistakably the Colombian Caribbean, as no one else can conjure it up, with its blue herons, palm-fringed lagoons, squalor and sensuality, and the sea, sometimes sleepy, sometimes terrifying. That, of course, is also the setting of his greatest works, 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera. It is a world populated by silver-haired dandies in white linen suits and imperiously beautiful women crooning boleros. Music occupies a central place in Latin American life, as it does in Until August. It's hard to imagine, for example, that Bach, as the surname for his protagonist, was chosen by accident. La sensación de fe, que las cosas van a salir bien. In the book, he sketches the complicated complicities and compulsions of love and sex. His prose is generally precise and vivid, and beautifully translated into English by Anne MacLean. With it, Mr. García Márquez creates an atmosphere as few other writers can. But on this occasion, he doesn't do as much with it as he might have in his prime. Whether a dead author's wishes regarding unpublished material should always be respected is a vexed question. Few today would quibble with the decision of Max Brod, Franz Kafka's friend and literary executor, to publish The Trial against the writer's instructions. More questionable were the actions of Ernest Hemingway's publishers. They marketed four works assembled from unfinished material many years after the author's death. You think something is in shape to be published, or you don't, and Hemingway didn't, complained Joan Didion, an American writer, speaking for many creators. Mr. García Márquez's Spanish editor, Cristóbal Pera, claims to have hewed closely to the original. He approached it, he said, as a restorer facing a great master's canvas. Indeed, Gonzalo García, Mr. García Márquez's son, described the editor's work as archaeological, of collecting all the manuscripts of the novella that existed.
Ha hecho Cristóbal Pera, sobre todo, es un trabajo más bien de arqueología, de recolectar entre todos los manuscritos, que los mecanuscritos que existían.
Diehard fans will rejoice at this posthumous bonus track from an author who was not just an international celebrity, but a national icon in Colombia. A former president of the country, Juan Manuel Santos, has read these works aloud at an event in the National Library in Bogotá.
El coronel destapó el tarro de café y comprobó que no había más de una cucharadita. Retiró la olla del fogón, vertió la mitad del agua en el piso de tierra y con un cuchillo raspó el interior del tarro.
But others may find it hard to banish a slight queasiness, much as Anna Magdalena Bach felt on the return ferry from the island, at the commercial opportunism surrounding its publication.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. I wanted to get the music for the final countdown inserted right about here.
Because, you know, maybe that will drive the point home that you only have until this Sunday to take advantage of our half-price offer on Economist Podcast Plus subscriptions. In an election year, do you really want to be missing out on Checks and Balance, our weekly podcast on all things American politics? No. So join us. For a year or two, you could be paying less than $2.50 a month to access some of our best stuff. Follow the link in our show notes or search for Economist Podcast Plus online to get in on the action. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.